Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. And we are actually off this week because we put so much into the summer movie preview episode from last week. So if you haven't heard that one, be sure to listen to that. It's a great episode where we go through every single movie coming out this summer. And dates are always subject to change because they do move around a little bit. You might notice Kraven, The Hunter, literally moved after we dropped that episode to Christmas. So that one won't actually be coming out. But everything else is pretty much holding still. This episode, though, we wanted to share our spinoff podcast, inspired by a true story, which is true crime with a movie tint. And what I mean by that is we take a movie that was inspired by a true story and look at the crimes behind it. It's really about the crimes that inspired that film. And then kind of that's the first half, is going through the crimes and everything else. And the second half is reviewing the film on its own merits. Does that film stand up, etc.? Is it respectful to the victims? And kind of looking at it from that angle in terms of the crimes and the film itself. It's just it's something that wasn't being done. It wasn't really being done in the ether. I mean, we wanted to kind of put our own spin on true crime. I think it's coming along great. We've had a lot of growth over the last month or two on this particular podcast, which is phenomenal. And we're very, very excited about that. Want to make sure, like, you Hollywood Outsider listeners, you might have heard us talk about it. I'm sure you've heard us talk about it, but you haven't actually listened to the episodes. So what I've done is put two of them in this one feed. Pick your poison or listen to both of them. I don't know. But I'm hoping once we're done with this episode, you like it so much, you go to Inspired by a True Story in your podcast app of choice and hit subscribe. And then you can listen to every episode after that. Huh? I hope so. I hope you enjoy it enough. So what I'm going to do is in this episode, check timestamps in the show notes if you want to know which time each one starts. But we have Mississippi Burning and The Strangers. I figured it would be a good time to come back to The Strangers just because the new reboot is coming out this month. And Mississippi Burning is one of our most heralded episodes. People have praised that one pretty much the most out of all of them. So I think these are two really good examples of the show and what we're trying to do. And hopefully you enjoy it and you get to hear me, my own Robert Stack impersonation, if you will. I hope you like it. We're going to start with Mississippi Burning. We're going to end with The Strangers. There are actually two true stories that lead to The Strangers situation. So that's why that one's last, because it's a longer episode. But I hope you guys enjoy both of them. If you only want to listen to one or the other, hit the show notes, find the timestamps, and go check that out. But in the meantime, we're going to start with Mississippi Burning. It's going to lead right into The Strangers, and we'll talk more on The Hollywood Outsider next week. Here we go. Here's Mississippi Burning.
Please be warned. Inspired by a True Story deals with crimes that may contain adult themes and violence, and is intended for a mature audience.
June 1964. Three young men took part in what was known as Freedom Summer, a three-month initiative to register black people in the South to vote. Suddenly, they went missing. In 1988, director Alan Parker recreated these events in a phenomenal film that became nominated for Best Picture and starred the talents of Willem Dafoe, Frances McDormand, and Gene Hackman. It's hard to believe, but this was only 60 years ago, and Mississippi Burning was indeed inspired by a true story. Welcome to True Crime for Cinephiles. This is Inspired by a True Story, a podcast devoted to keeping artists honest. After listening, or right now, whenever you choose, please leave our show a review on your app of choice and share Inspired by a True Story on Reddit or X or wherever you share your true crime podcast. We do appreciate it. And you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're going to describe and discuss the overall details of the actual crimes and also review the film on its own, how much of that is true, and how much was Hollywood magic. I'm Aaron Peterson, an accredited film critic for the Hollywood Outsider podcast and website. Joining me today are my fellow film critics and true crime devotees, Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
And John Davenport.
Hey, buddy.
Well, this is a heavy one. Agreed?
Absolutely. I'm actually surprised I haven't seen this movie before.
Hang on. This was in your blind spot?
This one was in my blind spot. And seeing Gene Hackman on screen is a work of art.
Please tell me you have seen Gene Hackman on screen before.
No, I have. It's okay. Just been so long.
Oh, man. When he retired or just disappeared or went in the WITSEC or whatever he did.
Started just doing car commercials with voiceovers.
Something. Man, it broke my heart. He's one of my favorite all-time actors. He's in the top 10 for sure.
Do you guys want to know how I was introduced to him as an actor?
To Gene Hackman?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I think.
Yes. I'm curious what you guys think the first movie I saw with him in it was. That was notable to me.
Oh, Heartbreakers.
It is Heartbreakers.
I was going with Loose Cannons. I was just going to go for Dan Aykroyd for no reason.
No, it was Heartbreakers. I loved that movie.
Is that the one where he was smoking and dirty and just gross half the movie?
Yeah, he was. Yes, he was.
Wow.
It was great. I loved it. I was like, this dude is so creepy and hilarious, and I kind of love him, but kind of don't.
Yeah, it's Jennifer Love Hewitt, Sigourney Weaver.
Mm-hmm.
Ray Liotta.
Yep.
Ray Liotta and Jason Lee. That's a trifecta of early 2000s right there.
Oh, God, it's so good. I still rewatch that one. But anyway, sorry to completely derail.
Can I ask you a question since you... I assume you've seen him in other movies, right? I know. Yeah. Not just Heartbreakers and Mississippi Burning.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I have.
It's like, because that's a wide variance for sure. Were you surprised? Had you seen this one before we announced we were going to do this for the podcast, or is this new to you too?
This was in my blind spot also. So yeah, I was a bit shooketh. I had no idea and didn't really know what all I was going into, because I'm going to be honest with you, if they did teach this story to me at some point in school, I don't remember that. I'm not going to say that I wasn't taught it about it, but I sure don't remember this. So the entire historical context was not in my viewpoint, nor was this movie. So I think one of the things that I told you, because we did reschedule the recording for this a couple of times, and that is all my bad, but one of the things that I told you...
I wasn't going to point my finger at you, but if you want to take it, sure.
I'll take it. Yeah. I'll own it. But one of the things that I told you when you were asking me, like, because I have a terrible memory, so I have to watch the movies pretty much like the night before we record, so it's fresh in my memory. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm not going to rewatch this again. Like, this is one of those where it's like, I'm glad I saw it. I'm glad I know what happened, but it's really just like too devastating to go through again. Like, I have enough recollection that I don't want to go through, you know, viewing that again. It's just a really sad story. So, yeah, I mean, I had no idea about a lot of this, and I'm glad that it's kind of in my scope now that I've seen it.
What I find fascinating is same thing happened when I was in school. I remember when they taught about civil rights, because this is before I was born. So, I mean, this is my parents' generation. Amanda, you're probably your grandparents' generation, I would guess. So it's, you know, it's a, mm-hmm. it's a completely before my time generation that this happened, but it wasn't that long ago. It's one of those things where my parents recall it. My grandparents knew it well. You know what I mean? Like, they knew these stories. And in school, civil rights was taught, but the movement, Martin Luther King, you know, a high level. The details, the horrors, those were not taught in my school. I don't know if that happened in other schools, and maybe it's a jurisdiction thing. I don't know. But I definitely did know this story when Mississippi Burning came out, because I'll be honest, I saw this, and I had seen other horrors in terms of the Black experience in America, like Roots. Obviously, I had seen that. My mother made me watch that one. She said that was very important to watch, and I understand that more now than I did at the time. But she wanted to make sure I saw this one, too. Like, it was very important to her that I understood history and the history of the country and why people feel a certain way about things, because so often people want to say, well, we've progressed. We're here. We're there. Yeah, but you also need to understand why people and families feel this way. You know, you can't just chop it up to, well, we're past that. Well, some people, that's a long scar, you know? Families carry that thing for generations. It's good to understand it. And I think it's good that this movie was made and it brought about the discussion of those points so that we remind ourselves that things like this happened not too far ago.
Yeah, the impact of this movie had the same sort of impact that the first episode of Watchmen had on me, where it taught me about the Tulsa massacre.
Yeah, that was an interesting spot to put that. I only knew basic undercurrents of that story until Watchmen, and I'm like, it's wild that I'm learning more from a sci-fi show than I learned in school.
Absolutely. That's what the crazy part of that is. This movie really had that effect on me where it took me into that moment, especially those moments where you see what the white community was doing to the black community in this town as a whole and how much these people were living in fear and squalor just to stay out of the way of these people who were willing to hurt them for no other reason than the color of their skin. It's sad. It's heartbreaking. It's everything that they depicted, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic. And you know what? We should probably get into the actual details because you want to know what's true and what's not, right? That's why you came here. So as of this recording, Mississippi Burning is streaming on Tubi. Plus, you can rent it digitally anywhere, but that is always subject to change. And if you are unfamiliar with the plot, because sometimes you just come for the crime, that's fine. That's fine. I want to take a pause for a second. Thank you to everybody that has been sharing the show. We've been seeing growth that we really appreciate. And a lot of more people listening and sharing and finding the show. And that's all because of you listening. So thank you so much for that. I just want to make sure I extend that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been fun seeing everyone share the show back and forth and all the posts about, hey, you know, so-and-so, you should come check this out. It's really a lot of fun to see the new people coming on board because of like sharing and all that. So thank you so much, everybody.
What they said. Thank you.
Really? That's what you got? That's the best.
Do you really want me to be Amanda and just say the exact same thing you guys just said, but a lot longer?
Fair point. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. No, all right, then.
Mississippi Burning stars Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe as agents Rupert Anderson and Alan Ward, or Mr. Ward, two FBI agents tasked with finding three young men who disappeared in Mississippi and are believed to have been murdered. The film follows their rather complex path to justice and also stars Frances McDormand, Brad Dourif, Arlie Ermey, Michael Rooker, Frankie Faison, and was nominated for numerous Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Gene Hackman, and Best Actress for Frances McDormand. So that's pretty awesome. New episodes of Inspired by a True Story are released every 2 weeks and can be found wherever you listen to podcasts or at thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can hear episodes early if you support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider, or you can just share your thoughts on this episode, or even suggest a film if you want to, by emailing us inspired@thehollywoodoutsider.com. Film and true crime fans are always debating how true their true crime is, so prepare to take a trip back to a period in America, which for many wasn't really that long ago. This is Mississippi Burning. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, was founded in April 1960 by youths dedicated to nonviolent direct action tactics in regards to the civil rights movement. Their original statement of purpose, drafted by student James Lawson, was, and I quote, "We affirm the philosophical or religious ideal of nonviolence as the foundation of our purpose, the presupposition of our faith, and the manner of our action. Nonviolence, as it grows from Judeo-Christian traditions, seeks a social order of justice permeated by love." In 1961, the SNCC offered freedom rides to solidify the Supreme Court's ruling that stated segregation in regards to interstate travel facilities was unconstitutional. Though they were repeatedly attacked while providing these rides, this collective and the initiative grew. These efforts gave way to increased voter registration efforts by the SNCC. The SNCC even supported the formation of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, an effort to dismantle the state's whites-only Democratic Party. And in June 1964, approximately 1,000 volunteers gathered for training to learn how to register black voters amidst other endeavors. This became known as Freedom Summer, a 3-month initiative devoted to getting black voters registered. At the same time, 21-year-old James Earl Chaney, 20-year-old Andrew Goodman, and 24-year-old Michael Schwerner were deep in Mississippi working on just that endeavor, helping get black voters registered. Chaney was black, and both Goodman and Schwerner were Jewish. They even wanted to set up a freedom school in Neshoba County to assist voters with the legitimacy tests required for voting at that time. According to the FBI, the Ku Klux Klan, a renowned organization built on hate and white supremacy, had been looking specifically for Michael Schwerner. The Klan derived their name from the Greek word, kyklos, meaning circle. They had gone relatively quiet as an organization after 1944, until the civil rights movement in the 60s brought them roaring back to life. They intimidated, they terrorized, they tortured others in the name of white supremacy, including using whippings, shootings, and even bombings to threaten civil rights workers and those in support of equality. Michael Schwerner had been particularly active in boycotts of biased businesses, helping with voter registration at this time. The Klan, as they were otherwise known, was not going to let these efforts by Schwerner go unanswered for. On June 16th, the Klan descended on a local church looking for Schwerner, but he was not present. These Klan members proceeded to beat the churchgoers and burn the church down to the ground. And by doing so, they also set a trap. June 21st. The three young men, James Earl Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, traveled to visit the community of Longdale, Mississippi, to investigate this burned church. Schwerner told his superiors that if they were not back by 4 p.m., they needed to start trying to locate them. He understood there was a risk. After leaving Longdale at about 3 p.m., headed to Meridian, Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner were pulled over for speeding in Philadelphia, Mississippi. They were arrested by Deputy Sheriff Cecil Price and detained for several hours. Later that night, the three men were all released. They gathered back together and hit the road, heading toward Meridian, Mississippi, in their blue station wagon. But upon leaving, their car was followed. According to FBI reports, this was a preordained plan by the Ku Klux Klan. They were not even out of Neshoba County when they were pulled over one final time. And they were never, ever seen alive again. The next morning, activists reported their disappearance. The Department of Justice was notified, and Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy immediately tasked the FBI to investigate. On June 23rd, FBI agents followed intelligence that they had gathered to lead them to the remains of the blue station wagon. It had been set on fire, burned to the core. This piece of evidence led to the FBI naming the case MI Burn, which stands for Mississippi Burning. For the next month and a half, the FBI led an enormous search, assisted by the National Guard, on a hunt for the bodies of these three young men. According to the FBI, they were putting pressures on established Klan members and even developing Klan informants and plants. They opened a new field office in Jackson, Mississippi, as ordered by President Lyndon Johnson. Over this period of time, it was established that the KKK was definitely behind this disappearance. After their release from jail on June 21st, led by Deputy Cecil Price and others, allegedly totaling 10 men involved. They followed these young men until they were on a desolate stretch of Highway 19, and they forced them to Rock Cut Road. They turned on their lights and pulled the men over again. According to witnesses, meaning those involved that testified for leniency, Alton Roberts, a 26-year-old dishonorably discharged Marine, was officially the trigger man. He approached Schwerner and asked him, "Are you that N-word lover?" when Schwerner began to reply, that he understood how he felt. Alton Roberts shot Schwerner at point-blank range, and then also shot Goodman as well as Cheney, though it is stated that another man, James Jordan, also shot Cheney in the abdomen. This was after he was beaten and castrated. After the men were tortured and murdered, they loaded the bodies and took them to the property of Olin Barrage. He owned a cattle farm nicknamed Old Jolly Farm, and he was constructing a farm pond where he once jested that I got a dam big enough for 100 of them, implying he had room for 100 corpses. The disposal of the bodies had also been pre-planned. The three young men, 21-year-old James Earl Cheney, 20-year-old Andrew Goodman, and 24-year-old Michael Schwerner, three men at the beginning of their lives, were dumped into a hole and then buried. Goodman's autopsy eventually indicated that he had trace amounts of red clay in his lungs and also clasped in his hands. Goodman was likely buried while still somehow alive. According to Howard Ball's reporting for the University Press of Kansas, Deputy Price told the group of murderers after the burial, as witnesses claimed, and I quote, "Well, boys, you've done a good job. You've struck a blow for the white man. Mississippi can be proud of you. You've let those agitating outsiders know where this state stands. Go home now and forget it. But before you go, I'm looking each one of you in the eye and telling you this. The first man who talks is dead. If anybody who knows anything about this ever opens his mouth to any outsider about it, then the rest of us are going to kill him just as dead as we killed those three sons of bitches tonight. Does everybody understand what I'm saying? The man who talks is dead, dead, dead." Acting on an informant tip, the FBI found and exhumed the bodies on Roberts' property on August 4th, 1964. It would be several months before there were any arrests, but on December 4th, 1964, more than a dozen suspects, including Deputy Sheriff Cecil Price and his boss, Sheriff Lawrence Rainey, were indicted. Because Mississippi officials refused to prosecute the killers for murder, a state crime, mind you, the federal government, led by Prosecutor John Doerr, charged 18 individuals under federal charges with conspiring to deprive the three activists of their civil rights. You know, by killing them. The insanity of the trials that followed would require two more podcast episodes to wade through. We just don't have time to go through it all. Suffice it to say that after many years of court battles, on October 20th, 1967, seven of the 18 defendants named were found guilty of various crimes. Cecil Price, Klan Imperial Wizard Samuel Bowers, Alton Wayne Roberts, Jimmy Snowden, Billy Wayne Posey, Horace Barnett, and Jimmy Arledge. Sentences ranged from 3 to 10 years, and after exhausting their appeals, the seven began serving their sentences in March 1970. Not a single one of them served more than 6 years. The rest were acquitted. Even Edgar Ray Killen, part-time Baptist minister, and by the accounts of the witnesses, the plot leader. Killen avoided prison when a jury deadlocked 11-1 in favor of his conviction. The lone holdout said she could not, in good conscience, convict a preacher. That is, until June 21st, 2005, also known as Justice Day. On the 41st anniversary of the murders, Edgar Ray Killen was finally convicted of manslaughter. He died like a bitch in prison on January 11th, 2018. In 2016, Attorney General Jim Hood officially closed the investigation. Three young men drove into Mississippi with the intention of changing minds and lives. They knew the Klan was vengeful and wanted blood. And they went anyway. Because these men wanted to help. They believed equality was more important than their own safety and their own security. They believed in a peaceful solution to the civil rights issues of their time. They were then harassed, beaten, tortured, even castrated, and then murdered by a militia of small-minded cowards who mostly served 6 years or less for their crimes. In 60 years, it is true that we have come so far. For some, this is progress that demands to be touted from the rooftops every single day. But for others, it's only one generation's worth of history away.
I don't know what bothers me the most about this case, whether it was the killings, how difficult it was to bring people to justice, or how much time people spent paying for their crimes. All of that is crazy to me. It's just absolutely crazy. And then listening to the dates of some of this stuff that was going on, I'm sitting here going, reminding myself, oh, right. Some of this happened 10 years before I was born.
Yeah, it wasn't that long before.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, definitely what happened is the worst part of it, but it is so aggravating and insulting and just icky at A, how long it took, and B, the way that it was handled. You know what I mean? Like, it's, there's so much about this. Every aspect of it is just gross. And then you hear about how long it took for them to convict him, and that you had people who were willing to accept what he had done as his role, referring to killing, and got away with it because of his stature in the community, basically.
Well, because he was a preacher. I hate to break it to you. My grandfather was a preacher. I guarantee he'd be the first one to tell me, convict me if I did something horrible. So
isn't that like part of the job to be like, you don't sin?
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's like a whole 10 things that you're supposed to do.
those are, you know, like basically prerequisites. That's so
very important ones. Yeah.
These are your 15 crash 10, yeah. 10 commandments.
it's pretty horrible. And it's amazing to me that the state wouldn't file charges. They refused to prosecute, which it is apropos for the time, right? It's sad, but it's apropos for the time. Then what's funny to me, and I know Mississippi is different now. I know it. I'm sure it's come a long way. I have no doubt. Somebody listening is probably in Mississippi right now, and they love their state, and I'm happy for you. I'm glad that it's come so far. I drove through there when I was 20, so early 90s. mid-90s, whatever it was. And I'll never forget, I drove basically from the Midwest down to Florida. I was going to Disney World, but I was, you know, drinking age, so that's a whole nother story. But drove through Mississippi, and it was like entering a time warp, because it did very much feel like they didn't know that things had changed. Now, granted, this is a long time ago, but that was a long time after this. And it felt very much like there was still segregation going on. Like, it was very, there were pockets of black people, pockets of white people, and it felt very much like people knew their place, so quote unquote, you know, to that degree. And I'm sure it's changed. I know it's changed. I've been to Mississippi in the last 10, 15 years, and it's completely different than it was then. But man, it took a long time for progress to hit certain states. It's tragic, but it is a fact of our history. This is a very hard one to talk about too, because you don't want to.
It really,
you
know, is.
You mean because we're all white?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, if that's yeah. the, it's
truthfully,
fair.
I feel like that we should acknowledge that we're all white individuals who are speaking on this. Well, John's part white.
My tone, yeah, John is more of a bronze.
a bronze.
Half Mexican, half.
I am not the Mexican.
Yeah. Hispanic. Sorry. It's different. He's half Hispanic. He's Spanish.
Half Spanish and half
I'll let you guys keep fumbling around what it is. But, you know,
is it Spanish? Is it?
Yeah, let's just move on. It doesn't matter.
But the thing is like it's still relevant. Things that are happening overseas, and we're not going to get political, I promise you. But things that are happening overseas, it's still comparatively the same kinds of things happening. It's people being persecuted because they look different, because they believe in something different. They've done nothing to anyone and they're being beaten and tortured and murdered. Like this is a thing that happens in the world, and it's something that we should be learning from every day as we get older. And I'm not trying to get on a soapbox, but watching this movie just reminds me, like, every day we should remember this every day, that our own history, so we don't repeat the same mistakes, so we don't become other countries. You know what I mean? Because you see so much vitriol these days, and a lot of it seems to be based on racial lines. It's important to remember we never want to be that country again. Like, we just do not want to be that country again. And I mean as a whole. I'm not talking about just me. I just mean as a whole. We do not want to be that country again.
It's really hard to continue the road of this conversation without thinking about what things are like today. And the level of contention we live in today is heartbreaking. It's scary. And it's disappointing to see that there are so many people who are willing on any side, not just either side, but any side of whatever conversation you're trying to have, that are so willing to just forego respect, niceties, any of those things to just prove whether or not their way of thinking is better than somebody else's. This movie reminded me a lot of that. Ideologies in the investigation was something that was also something that came up a lot throughout my research and how they were handling it. So it's just crazy how people can stick to their guns too much, so much so that they don't care who they hurt along the way.
The thing that I guess find myself frustrated with, you know, from like a my experience, my world experience perspective, is that, to your point, yes, this is something we should know about. And it just takes me back to why was this not talked about when I was growing up? You know what I mean? Like, instead, I feel like our society would be in such a different position right now. And granted, yeah, we've had progress, but let's be honest, it's still really shitty. It's not good. We're not in a good place by any means still. Like, there's so much racial divide that still exists. And now people are either just like really quiet about their racism, or there's a lot of people who just have no filter.
I mean,
it's improved, but like, it's still not good.
I'm not playing devil's advocate, but I will say there are also times where people are afraid to have a conversation because they're afraid they will be called racist. Look, we're tiptoeing around a conversation that there's no reason we should have to tiptoe around it. It's a legitimate conversation that people can have. And I think in this day and age, for whatever reason, race is very polarized. It's used every avenue for polarization. It's hard to discuss race unless you're talking with people you know very well and you know you can trust. In an open forum on a podcast, it's very, very tricky because one thing gets taken out of context and boom, it's all over the internet. You know what I mean? It's not hard to do that. And by God, podcasts want to go viral. They do not want to go viral for those reasons.
Well, I mean, I'll still stand with, I think we've had a lot of improvement and progress, but we still have a long ways to go.
As long as we acknowledge the progress that we have had, I think it's also important to acknowledge the progress we have, because that wasn't that long ago. And can you imagine this happening today and the same situation happening? Like, people just not being held accountable?
Yes.
Okay, well, it's an honest
I feel
question.
Like that's all the last 5 years have taught me, is that people will not be held accountable for racial and violent acts that result in someone being hurt or murdered. That is literally all I feel like I've learned in the years that I've become more aware of our country and news and media. And like, granted, it's because to your point, it is a more polarizing topic. Like, these things were happening all of the time. So it was the norm, you know, when this was occurring. It still is, like, look at how much pushback and riots, even like everything and just all of these different means of communicating, we don't accept this, to our legislators, to our government, to our public officials.
What do you mean that we don't accept this? I didn't understand what you meant.
That, like, we as a society are pushing back and saying it's not okay that these people aren't being held accountable for what they're doing wrong, and that this is very wrong, and our and like voices are still not being heard on that, or at least like we've had small steps, but there's still so much that has gone unaccounted for. And granted, now it may just feel like it's a lot because it's becoming more prevalent again, but I do feel like we're in a very, still very sad place within our country. But what I was going to say, like that's where fair. I was going with that's all fair. Of this, is I think we would be in a better position as a society if we were honest in our school systems. If we, as Americans, took accountability and acknowledged truly the level and degree of just brutality that has existed in our past, and we knew about these exact situations to really bring it to the forefront of your mind. Like, the things that are taught in schools about slavery and racism are so, they feel so disconnected from current day, but they could easily be teaching about the things that are, you know, still a little bit closer to our timeline and more relevant to us and to children in schools. And then I think everybody would grow up and say, yeah, that was really horrible. We learned about that as students, instead of being adults saying, I've never heard of this. This came out of nowhere. Is this even like a real historical event? And it creates more questionability because where's the validity? Like, we question everything now. We have to. Nothing feels valid anymore. But if we would have known these things growing up and we all knew about them consistently through our school system, we would feel and react differently because it would be the same as knowing 2 + 2 = 4. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I don't think a lot of things were really taught very well. Like, I believe it was I know it's the 15th Amendment, but I think it was like the late 1800s or whenever it was, 1870-ish, something like that, when the amendment to ratify voting rights happened. But then they had, or to enact exact that amendment. And then, you know, for the Voting Rights Act in the 60s, they actually had to do it again and basically say, stop being racist about this. They have the right to vote, because so many things were being done to take that vote away from Black people. And, you know, that doesn't get taught in school very much. It's always like, it was always being glossed over. And now I think we're in an era where people don't want that taught anymore because we should be beyond it. And I think that's just it's an unreasonable expectation. It's easy for you because if you're a white person, you think it makes you look bad. You know, well, I wasn't part of it. Great. You weren't part of it, but it happened. And people have a right to understand that happened in the country so that they can ensure to learn from it and grow from it. Because I am a firm believer that if you do not if you do not keep up with something, you will repeat these mistakes. You just will. The world will find a way to do horrible things yet again in some fashion.
I agree with both of what you guys are saying. The thing is that for the last 60 years, we have done, let's just talk about all the nice things. Let's talk about all the good things. We haven't done let's face all the facts, and we need to start doing that, because the lesson isn't setting in the way it should be, especially now that you look at there are people who are actively trying to take out parts of this history and even water it down even more than what we already had, because we shouldn't be making people quote unquote feel bad. We need to be teaching people about why everything about the 60s, 50s, I can't count backwards, why they were not great for certain people.
They weren't great for anyone except white dudes. I mean, women couldn't even vote until I think 1920 or something like that. So it's like nonstop.
Right. It's just like the Holocaust. That was something that we didn't gloss over in school. We were taught about the Holocaust to a degree that this is really bad. we are doing the best we can to not let something like that happen again. And we all have a reaction to seeing something happen like that that's in that neighborhood. We should be having that same sort of reaction when it comes to finding out about Tulsa, finding out about Mississippi burning, understanding why Juneteenth is such a big day.
One of the other things that I think about is, and I'll use an analogy, but you kind of referenced how society has a difficult time. Some of society has a difficult time facing the history because it's almost like a defensive measure. Like, I wasn't the one who personally did that, so don't attack me. Like, what do I have to do with this? And instead, I think we as a society should think about it more like this analogy. Somebody does a really crappy job in their job, and let's say they're a leader. They leave, you take over that job, you inherit all of the crap that they left you, whether you knew about it or not, but you still have to be the one to say, I'm so sorry that this happened to you. Let me find a way to rectify it. Let me find a way to make it better. I'm not the one who did the wrong to you. This happened to you before I even came around, but this is my role to play in this situation. I am now going to accept that I have to do something about it because of the position I'm in. And the position that we as a society are in are freaking human beings trying to do right by other human beings, all of them. It doesn't matter if you agree with them or like them or not. They're still human beings. Like, that's the way I wish we would all collectively think about the situation instead of it being, well, that's not my problem. I didn't do it. So, you know, and this didn't happen directly to you. Maybe it didn't happen directly to you, but you can definitely trace and see the level of impact that it had on their entire family and generations and see the historic. You just have to be open-minded to understanding that. And again, I think it comes back to if you didn't learn about it growing up, you're going to have a harder time accepting it. It's your surroundings and your environment that have influenced you to feel one way or another. And we didn't do a good enough job in our country of making sure that this didn't happen again, or that people understood why it wasn't okay, why it's not okay.
Do you think this movie does a good job of representing the events that happened?
Wholeheartedly. They don't do it in a way that hides the events. They show it to you right there in color, and they show the events as harsh as they could possibly do for the time in which they're making this movie. So we're talking about the 1980s. It's supposed to be a big movie. They're not doing it. It's not like we're watching 12 Years a Slave and we're watching the horrors that way. For 1980, it's pretty close. Or 1980s, as it was an 88 movie. Yep. It's pretty close. The movie itself does shows the crime. It shows how they hid the bodies. It shows what kind of people were involved. They weren't just the hillbillies and the people who you can point out from a lineup of, oh, that's just bad people. You can see it's police officers, it's pastors, it's everybody. I think they did a really good job of depicting it in the movie.
All right, so as a standalone film, Amanda, without any knowledge of the case, watching it, you said you couldn't rewatch it. And I think we've kind of learned as to why, just the horrors of it all. But did you think of the film overall as you're watching it? Did it impact you in the right ways, in the way that the film is intending to impact you? Did it impact you in a negative way? Like, just how did it impact you, I guess?
It's a very gut-wrenching film, and especially when you don't know fully what to expect. I mean, obviously, I had like an understanding, and I could kind of figure out, you know, if this is civil rights related and the title is Mississippi Burning, I know enough history to make a presumption that turned out to be fairly accurate, but not to the degree that I was expecting. So I was still beyond mortified by this entire thing. But in terms of a film, it's a really good film to showcase what happened. And from what I understand of, you know, all of the details of the case, it does fairly reflect what actually happened. And it doesn't do it in like a preachy way of like, here's history, do better. You know, we need to not do this, but it's more like, here's what happened. And you, I guess if you're like a good, decent human being with empathy, you're like, wow, this is horrifying that this situation happened and that it got to that point that all of that, so many people were able to excuse it and make it okay in their minds. And that, I think, makes it a good film because it's making you reflect and feel and think and want to make sure you and everyone around you are doing things different than they were then. It creates a self-awareness. And the performances were fantastic.
Oh, my God. Everybody in this, Frances McDormand, who has gone on to be a 2-time Oscar winner, I think. She is always great. Always. She's just always great. And her role is really kind of, it's honestly the one role that doesn't need to be here, but I think they're just trying to show this is what, you know, there were some good people that just didn't know what to do that were trapped in this situation. I think is kind of the element they're going for, because the wife situation isn't something that happened. That was just an added dramatic element. I don't know if that's necessary, but she's still fantastic. And Gene Hackman, always crushes it. I have, even in bad movies, he's great. I mean, he's kind of like the Michael Caine of it all. You know, he can show up in Jaws Revenge and he'd still be great. You know, it's like, he's just one of those actors that can always be interesting no matter what he's doing, even if he's phoning it in, which he's totally done many times. I like that the FBI is shown to be actually solving the crime, because they did in the real world. They did solve this crime. Like, they were the ones that brought them to justice. The state of Mississippi had no interest in bringing these men to justice. None. The U.S. government did. And I know we're in a time where the FBI is really being looked at by both parties and stuff constantly, and one thinks are in the pocket of one party and the other
always scrutinized.
Yeah. I think it's important to remember some of the wins that the FBI have had, and this is one of their wins.
That's a positive way to look at that. I like that.
I was just so happy to see Gene Hackman, because it's been so long since I've seen him on screen. And you're right. The Replacements, completely phoning it in that movie. He's having a good time. He's a lot of fun in that movie. And in this movie, he acts as a character that has several different intensities that are frightening, but jovial, but flirty and fun and just charming at every single turn. He can terrify a scary person at a whim. So there are so many different things that he's doing in this, and he's acting. I think, Aaron, you said this once, Gene Hackman's who actors wish they were when they go to bed, you know, and it's very true. This movie is a good example of that.
So Gene Hackman, one thing that always amazed me about him is that he's very, in terms of how he looked, he reminds me so much of my grandfather. Every time I look at him, maybe that's why I came to love him to begin with, because he does look a lot like my grandpa. He just randomly, I don't know why, but he does look a lot like my grandpa, especially in this movie. So the whole time I'm watching it, I hadn't seen it in a long time. I'm like, I remember he looks like my grandpa. But he has this thing where...
Oh, that's really sweet.
He has this thing about him where he looks like my grandpa. My grandpa was not a threatening man. I don't think Gene Hackman looks like a threatening man. In fact, most of the movie, he's very charming. He's the kind of guy you'd love to have a beer with. But when he does play, I'm about ready to beat the shit out of Brad Dourif in a barber's chair, I believe every second of it. Like, he's got that, he's got that switchblade, or he's got that, he's got that street razor to his throat, and, you know, he's doing the shit. And I think he's going to cut his throat. I've seen this movie 10 times and I still think, like, I can't remember. Does he cut his throat? I feel like he's going to cut his throat. And he's just, it's so threatening and menacing, and he can pull that off like nobody else has been. Unforgiven, obviously, he won an Oscar for that. Very similar kind of, like, high, that undercurrent of ferociousness that he had in that movie, he also brings to this role. And I just...
Which, interestingly, I don't mean to interrupt you, but interestingly, this movie, Mississippi Burning, I don't know which scene it was, but there's a whole report about how Gene Hackman said, because of this movie, he's not going to do violent movies anymore. He doesn't want to be seen that way anymore after this movie.
Oh, wow.
This one or Unforgiven?
This one. It was only because Clint Eastwood showed up at his house and begged him to be in Unforgiven, that he decided to go ahead and do Unforgiven because he did not want to be that kind of guy anymore.
That is a very interesting backstory I did not know about.
Yeah, no, that was one of the things that I found fascinating about this, because somebody who does a piece of art sees how people are seeing it and goes, yeah, that's not for me anymore. Especially with Hollywood being the way we see Hollywood so often, that, you know, that's pretty great. You were talking about the scene with Brad Dourif where you're like, he's going to really cut him. What about the scene with Michael Rooker where he's sitting there holding on to his, you know, his parts?
Oh, yeah. That was an intense scene, too. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was convinced he had Michael Rooker by the jewels the whole time.
Maybe. Knowing him, he probably did, honestly.
Yeah, Michael Rooker is like probably going, I need you to really grab him.
So what did you want? You wanted to say something about Willem Dafoe? Is that what you wanted to talk about?
Well, I wanted to talk about Willem Dafoe because this is like Willem Dafoe before he was Willem Dafoe. It was just surprising to see him in this movie because I didn't even realize it was him for the first few minutes. But again, he's doing a role that is so straight-laced and so controlled that it gives Gene Hackman all the room in the world to become the character that we see. And I think it's a nice balance between the two of them. And then when we go into the really crazy portion of this movie, like, I really love that line when Gene Hackman's like, do you think he was going to really shoot me? And then he goes, probably, you know, that was a really good measure of those two characters and how they're growing together.
Yeah, very much. Great performance. It's amazing to me how many wonderful actors are in this movie as you watch. And you're like, just, oh my God, that guy's awesome. That guy's awesome. That person's awesome.
It was Kevin Dunn's first movie.
There's so many people in here. Michael Rooker's in it. Like, there's just so many great actors in this movie and they're all bringing their A game. And you know, it's not easy to portray those parts. So that was impressive. Any other standouts or things you want or issues that you had with the movie?
One thing I'll say is that they did a really good job of trying to lace in just how much the two different cultures were clashing, not really clashing, but were living side by side. You know, you mentioned Frances McDormand's character and how she's supposed to be playing this character, which in the real life story, there were people who were feeding information to the FBI, and she kind of represents that. As a whole, there were more people than just her in the real story, but she represents that those people who wanted to continue to live life better, with more open and with everybody. The other thing that I was just brokenhearted by is like the kind of squalor that they end up showing how the black community is living, and then just how much like the white community would show up and be like, all right, well, we're gonna burn this whole place down. Like, a lot of that was kind of disheartening.
Yeah, well, they also showed clearly that when they dropped old Whitey off in the middle of the neighborhood, that he runs out as quickly as possible because he knows, oh, that's different when I don't have my buddies with me.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I don't know that there's anything I would want to change from the film.
No.
I think it was a well-made movie that really captured the events, but I think to John's point earlier, it wasn't overly gratuitous or like to where it's hard to even handle. It doesn't get to that level.
No, it doesn't. Well, here's what the movie got right and did it respect the victims. I would say no, because the names were changed. So the true killers were never truly named. They have different names.
That's a really good point. That was really, I was confused why that was done.
I got to assume it's to just keep themselves free of liability, but they were convicted. So as far as I'm concerned, who care? I mean, you can use their names. They were convicted. So it's not like you're projecting a falsehood.
There's no slander or something.
It's a weird choice, but to each their own. So I think that was really a miss on the film's part. I think the young men that lost their lives have no voice in this movie. I would have liked to have just seen their avenues, their activities, what they had been doing, to show what they risked, that they knew they were risking their lives and that they did this because they thought it mattered more than not doing anything. And I think that's very important to show personally. So that's one thing I do
that's
wish
a really good point.
Would have been changed. A lot of the racial issues that occur in the film happened at the time, or, you know, obviously around this time, but not necessarily over the course of this investigation. So some of the things that you see scattered throughout the film are recorded incidents. They just didn't happen necessarily during this investigation. It's just to showcase how divided. Yeah, how divided the world was, the state was, the community was, and also just to kind of highlight that these are the things that happen in these communities. The castration story that Monk tells, the one where he's, you know, got these guys' balls in his hand and he's getting ready to cut them and he's got them tied to a chair and everything else, that story is a very true story that happened to a black man by a Klansman. So it is a true story. It's not how the story was conveyed, but it's a very true story that he shared. And the wife giving up her deputy husband was not the case. It took a long time, rattling of two witnesses, and even some alleged payouts to witnesses to really bring this case to a head. But there were a lot of behind-the-scenes dealings to make this thing come down.
One thing that I appreciated from the true story to this was how they showed exactly how many people rolled into this town to start doing the searching.
Man, I love when they just called the guard in. They're just like, yeah, bring these bitches in! And then all of a sudden, now we're taking over the town. Go ahead, get Lippy with us now, town.
Yeah. You are literally being invaded right now. Yep. Good job.
It's just, I mean, that's totally, that's the FBI saying, nah, you thought you were a badass, but we're here and we're bigger than you. We can bring all the people we need, because they are treating them like shit the entire investigation until they finally find the car and they know that these boys are likely dead. Then suddenly, okay, well, we're just going to get real with you. You guys don't want to help? We're going to make you help.
That's one of the things that I think is crazy is that, again, going back to the original case, it took so much money to bring people to justice. It took massive amount of money and time and energy to bring these people to justice. And yet they got 7 years.
On the opposite side of that coin, though, if they didn't spend the money, if they didn't prosecute them, the state wasn't going to do it. And if they didn't do something, nothing was going to change. That's one time where I think the federal government has to do whatever they can to ensure that this has to stop happening. We have to do everything we can, even if it only means 7 years. That's still, or 6 years. That's still 6 or 7 years someone doesn't want to give up of their life, right? So it at least is telling them there will be consequences. Because up to that point, it seemed like they were not getting consequences. You can even tell, I think the movie was really trying to convey that with how snarky the sheriff was when he got arrested. You know, he's just like, whatever, I'm going to be fine.
just the cockiness these people walk around with after committing these atrocities is incredible.
What the movie got wrong or left out, and was it worth it? The agents are representations of the collective of the time. So, you know, Mr. Ward and his... I always love when he yelled his name, too. It's just almost like an insult. I'm sorry, Mr. Ward. These two agents, which are Rupert Anderson and Alan Ward, they were not real agents. They're just basically a smorgasbord of FBI agents from the time.
Amalgamation.
There you go. There's another fancy word that I couldn't think of.
That's a $10 word. These stories kind of do that often, where they take a couple of people and they convert them into one person. Gilgo Beach did the same thing with one of their characters, where a single bad cop person to kind of be a whole bunch of different bad cops.
Well, when you need a bad cop, that's how you do it.
Get mayhem.
And now we arrive at the controversy of the film and my last thought on Mississippi Burning. So when the film was released, director Alan Parker and writer Chris Jeromo were surrounded by controversy, with Coretta Scott King famously calling the film out for being inaccurate. Though I would also stress that J. Edgar Hoover famously reacted very hostile to her husband, Martin Luther King. The reason for this commentary, though, is that the story in the film is framed primarily from the point of view of white men and white women. The activists who risk their lives and the black community members are either barely represented or shown to be meek individuals. The truth of the matter was that many black Americans were standing up for their communities every single day, leading this movement. And the activists that are the point of the film, they're little more than plot devices here. In real life, they had depth, They had complexity. They had honor in their character. When the movie made the cover of Time on January 9th, 1989, it did so under the subtitle, A New Movie's Searing View of Racism Stirs a Debate Over Fact Versus Fiction. It's true that the civil rights movement was led by black individuals. The white people did react and join in. We have come so far. I feel like we don't talk about that enough. We have come so far, but we still have black Americans persecuted in many areas of the country. But finally, their stories are being told. Mississippi Burning tells the story of an investigation, not a movement. I think that's very important to note that this film is about the investigation. Alan Parker, the film's director, stated at the time, the two heroes had to be white. This is a reflection of our society, as much as of the film industry. At this point in time, it could not have been made any other way. Is that an issue for you? Perhaps. But the film did showcase a truth that many Americans have been oblivious to. It turned that light onto a very important story. And while many of the events that you witness in the movie are from various accounts of separate incidents, they were still very true horrors that occurred at that time. So again, it's what's important to you. What truths are important to you? The whole truth or the pieces that illuminate a story? That's up to you. None of us can tell you what the right answer is. What I can tell you they did not do is they did not bother to give a voice to these activists that risked and gave their lives to this cause that they believed wholeheartedly in. The right to vote. I can't say that enough. That is one thing that really bothered me. Now, if those changes are worth it in order to tell this story, well, that's up to you. And I'll leave you with that. You decide. All right. Anything else on Mississippi Burning before we exit out of here?
No, I think that we covered just about everything we can cover. You're right. This is one of those cases that if we wanted to dig really deeper into the cases and what happened, it would take several episodes to do this.
It would. And it's still a hot button topic so many years later, which is kind of crazy.
Wild, actually.
All right, well, that's going to do it for Mississippi Burning. Thank you guys for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Our next one's going to be a little lighter because we're talking about porn. And
yes!
The movie.
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, God. Don't be that guy. We're talking about Wonderland, the John Holmes situation. That is going to be an interesting conversation. So thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, share the show on your social media outlets. Give us a review in your favorite podcast app. You are our best source of promotion, as you have proven. We really do appreciate it. Again, you can always find the show in any podcast app you use, as well as at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Tell your true crime friends about it. And thanks for listening to Inspired by a True Story. Now, let's keep those artists honest. August 1969. Four people have been tasked with a mission to murder strangers in the most gruesome fashion possible, the results of which haunted an entire nation for decades. In 2008, writer and director Brian Bertino took this notion and crafted one of the most terrifying thrillers of this century, one that answered the horrific question of why would you do this to us with a simple reply, because you were home. Be careful out there, because The Strangers was inspired by a true story. Welcome to True Crime for Cinephiles. This is Inspired by a True Story, a podcast devoted to keeping artists honest. We will discuss the overall details of the actual crimes, then review the film on its own, how much that's true and how much was Hollywood magic. I'm Aaron Peterson, an accredited film critic for the Hollywood Outsider podcast and a devoted true crime follower. And joining me are fellow film critics and true crime devotees, John Davenport.
Hi, how you doing today?
Wonderful. And Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
We got to get John. John, you got to get your own intro.
I really do, because I felt so awkward that just there. It was just...
hey, how you doing? Who popped into my living room?
I'm surprised we're here.
Well, we're talking about the Strangers this time, and we're talking about like both films. I just, you know, Renny Harlin is crafting a new trilogy of these, I think, for Netflix. But this is the original Strangers, 2008, and then a little bit of 2018's Strangers Prey by Night. Not so much the movie, but the Ketty murders, which obviously, if you're a real true crime devotee, you've heard of these before. What did you think of The Strangers, I guess, the first time you saw it?
For me, I have to admit, somehow The Strangers ended up being in my blind spot as far as movies are concerned. For as long as these movies have been around, I just never got around to watching them. So this is
what?
Watching it for this episode was like the first time I've got had a chance to experience it.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I can't remember my response when I first watched it, because I did watch it, you know, years ago, but I've watched it probably 3 to 4 times in total now. And I will say, as for the film itself, I don't feel like it is super rewatchable, but somehow I keep getting stuck rewatching it with people who haven't seen it is mm-hmm. typically what happens. And I think it's one that's, you know, it's still a good movie for like first time watchers, you know, to get familiar with it, but it does lose some of its oomph the second, third time around.
Once you see all the things that, man, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? What the hell were you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Those things.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, maybe call the police, not your boyfriend.
Look, the first time they came to the door, I would have called the police. Let's be honest. Like the first time. There wouldn't be a second time. It'd be like, it's 4 in the morning.
I wouldn't even show up to the door. You know what? This was 2008, but in 2023, I got a Ring doorbell. I'm not even answering the door. We're talking through the camera.
We're not talking. It's 4 in the morning. I'm just calling the police.
Yeah, no. 4 in the morning and the Ring camera's on. I'm not even talking. I'm just looking at the thing if I have to look at it. You know, I'm not giving that any more attention than it has to be.
Light bulbs unscrewed.
Yeah. That's never a good sign.
That was the first thing where I was like, dude, you knew that it was unscrewed. Now immediately call the police. But I will say, I will never, ever, ever, ever be the person who ignores my door because, and this is like a personal story, but I'll make it super quick. Mm. My nan, so my grandmother, several years ago, somebody broke into her house, attempted to murder her, beat her in the head with a hammer, tried to rape her. Like, it was really, really horrific. Drug her outside. She managed to get away and she went to the neighbor's house. And probably the only reason that she survived is because they opened the door and called the police and got her help.
Wow.
So that's where I'm like, I don't think I'll ever turn away answering the door, like trying to at least see if somebody's in help, needs help and has a need. But I'm probably not going to open the door right off the bat. You know what I mean? So yeah, I'd be still very precautious, but I personally can never not answer the door just because I never know if that situation could be on my doorstep.
Now, do you want to tell that story again, but with ominous music behind it?
Might as well at this point.
try to find the humor. That's all. That's all I'm trying to do.
Wait, where's the humor in this?
Nothing. That's a horrible story, but I'm glad she's okay. I'm glad she made
it. Yeah, she's not alive anymore, but she died from something else. She survived that. She was a fighter, and the neighbors were the ones who really did make sure she was okay and took care of her.
They're the real heroes.
She probably wouldn't have. Yeah.
They're the real heroes. Not the cops, not the firefighters, not the paramedics, but the neighbors are the real heroes. Mm-hmm. Screw those other people.
Well, they're the ones that gave her aid when she really needed it. So.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I would say so. Okay, so we're going to talk about a couple different crimes. We'll talk about one set, and then we'll come back, discuss, and then we'll go back to the other set. But I just want to point out, yes, these are cases that people probably have heard a thousand times, especially the Manson end of it, because the Manson murders did inspire the Strangers to a degree, and the Ketty murders inspired other aspects of the Strangers and Strangers Prey at Night. If you listen to true crime, you've probably heard of both of these cases. If you've been alive for any period of time, you've heard of the Manson case. But some of the details you might not know unless you watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because then you got a lot of them, but changed.
Yeah, just slightly different. You know, kind of like how Hitler didn't really die the way that he did in the other Tarantino movie.
Yeah. I like how he makes revisionist history, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's good how it's got a good beat. You can dance to it.
It's just like, this is how we wish it would have went. That's kind of how he does history. All right. Well, as of this recording, The Strangers is streaming on Netflix. That's always subject to change. But just in case somebody has not seen it and wants to check it out, 2008's The Strangers was written and directed by Brian Bertino and follows a young couple immediately following a wedding reception that led to a proposal gone bad. In other words, she said no. Scott Speedman stars as James Hoyt and Liv stars as... Stop, John. You hold your thoughts on the movie itself.
All right. Holding on it.
And Liv stars as Kristen McKay, and when they arrive home, it's very late at night, and strangers arrive at their door looking for someone that isn't there. What follows is a night of sheer terror as James and Kristen attempt to fend off three maniacs who happen to attack them just because they were home. And in 2018's The Strangers Pray at Night, which is the sequel, came like a decade later, a family of four stay at a remote mobile home park and are stalked by three strangers as well. That film starred Christina Hendricks and Martin Henderson and was written by Brian Bertino again, but also with Ben Cate, and directed by Johannes Roberts. I should say, some people haven't seen The Strangers Pray at Night. I think it holds up pretty closely to the original. So it's a good film. It's a very good film. This one's hard to talk about, but let's get into it. New episodes are released every 2 weeks and can be found wherever you listen to podcasts or at thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can also hear episodes early by supporting the show at patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Remember, film and true crime fans are always debating how true their true crime is. So let's answer the door. It's time to invite in the strangers.
These are the overall details of the case. Please be warned. Inspired by a True Story deals with crimes that may contain adult themes and violence and is intended for a mature audience.
July 25th, 1969. Charles Manson, an aspiring musician, and several of his followers moved to a remote ranch in Topanga Canyon, California. That same month, Manson family member Bobby Beausoleil stabs Gary Hinman to death. Hinman was a music teacher who introduced Manson to Beach Boys drummer Dennis Wilson, as well as record producer Terry Melcher. Beausoleil was accompanied by Mary Brunner and Susan Atkins. August 8, 1969. Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Charles Tex Watson were tasked by Charles Manson to scare Manson's old rival, record producer Terry Melcher. Melcher had refused to give Manson a record contract. They were ordered to kill everyone in Melcher's house as gruesome as they could. The only problem was that this house was now occupied by director Roman Polanski and his actress wife, Sharon Tate. While Polanski was in Europe working on a film, their friends Wojciech Frykowski and coffee heiress Abigail Folger were staying with Tate. Jay Sebring, a celebrity hairstylist and friend of Sharon's, was also there. Sharon Tate was more than 8 months pregnant. It was after midnight on August 8th when they arrived at 10050 CeeLo Drive. Tex Watson drove to the estate and immediately encountered a car driven by 18-year-old Stephen Parent. Stephen was simply visiting the caretaker on site, and he begged for his life, saying he would never, ever say a word. This is when Tex lunged at him with a knife, severing the tendons on his hand, and then proceeded to shoot him 4 times in the chest. They then pushed the car up the driveway. Tex Watson cut the phone line. Then he, Susan Atkins, and Patricia Krenwinkel broke into the house, leaving Linda Kasabian as lookout by the gate. Tex entered through a screened window and let the other two in through the front door. They found the four in the house: Tate, Frykowski, Sebring, and Folger. When Tex Watson found Sebring asleep on the couch, Sebring asked him who he was and what he was doing there. Watson's chilling and infamous reply was, "I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." Tex tied Tate and Sebring together by the necks with a nylon rope, throwing it then over the ceiling beams. When Sebring scoffed at the treatment of Tate, Tex Watson shot him. Folger went to the back bedroom to give the intruder $70 in hopes of sparing her life. Watson stabbed her 7 times. Somehow, she escaped into the pool area, where Krenwinkel caught up to her and stabbed her again. Then Watson joined in stabbing her a total of 28 times. Rakowski freed himself and began struggling with Atkins, who then stabbed his leg with a knife. He found his way out the front door, but Watson caught up, hitting him over the head with the gun, stabbing him multiple times. Some reports have it listed as over 50 times, and then shooting him twice. Linda Kasabian told Atkins she heard someone coming in an attempt to stop the murders. It did not work. Lastly, tragically, Sharon Tate pleaded to be allowed to give birth and offered herself as a hostage. They did not accept this. She was stabbed over 15 times by Atkins and Watson before being hung by a nylon rope. And before they left, they used Sharon Tate's blood to write the word pig on the front door. These are the murders that partially inspired the Strangers. But for those who don't know the rest of the Manson saga, let me explain. August 10th, 1969. The second set of murders occurred at the home of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca at the Los Feliz neighborhood of L.A., California. Charles Manson and several of his followers, including Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Linda Kasabian, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten, brutally murdered the LaBiancas. The LaBianca murders were also characterized by extreme violence. The victims were tied up, brutally stabbed, and killed. The word war was carved into Lino LaBianca's stomach. Similar to the Tate murders, the crime scene was staged to resemble a random act of violence. Phrases like death to pigs and rise were written in blood on the walls, and a fork was left in the abdomen of Lino LaBianca. The bodies of Lino and Rosemary LaBianca were discovered by their children when they returned home on the evening of August 10, 1969. The shocking and gruesome nature of the murder sent shockwaves to the community and law enforcement. On August 16, 1969, police arrested Charles Manson and several of his followers on unrelated charges. December 1, 1969, Charles Manson and more of his followers, including Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Charles Tex Watson, are charged with the Tate and LaBianca murders. June 15, 1970, the trial of Charles Manson and his followers begins. On January 25, 1971, Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Charles Tex Watson are found guilty of murder and other charges. March 29, 1971, Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Charles Tex Watson are sentenced to death. Later, their sentences are commuted to life in prison after the California Supreme Court invalidated the state's death penalty in 1972.
So these are some of the most gruesome murders that I think most of society is aware of. Like the things that they did, even the direction. So there's always a conversation of like, was Charles Manson really the one at fault here? Obviously, the court said, yep, sure was, because he gave the order. He's the one who directed them. He's the one who guided them to doing this. But there's like a level of vindictiveness in each of those individuals who took part in the crimes because of the extent they went to. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you probably really didn't need to grab some blood and write some words on the wall. You probably didn't need to leave a fork in someone's stomach. You probably didn't need to carve words into them. You probably didn't need to go hang them, and you probably also didn't need to make sure that they got stabbed 50 times or things like that. Like, these individuals enjoyed and took pleasure in being horrific.
You know, the thing that I always found shocking about the idea of the Manson family is just how small in stature Charles Manson is. He's not some giant. When you see him before he's in prison or anything like that, when he's out and about and being a normal human being, you don't see him and go, oh, he is the kind of person who can definitely get people to lead. He is this tiny little man who's just supplying drugs to people. And even then, when they finally caught him, he was a coward about it. He was hiding in underneath the bathroom sink. And the only reason why they found him was because he didn't clear his hair, his long hair out from the door, from the cabinet door in which he had closed himself into. Like, I will never understand how this whole thing happened when you have such a tiny little man who has
tiny little man.
He is so tiny. The only thing I can think of is that these people were high 90% of the time.
You never really will understand the appeal of a cult leader. I feel like unless you're in the cult, I don't think anyone has ever seen a cult leader and gone, I get it. You know, I really don't. It's amazing to me how things like this happen pretty regularly, that people are in a state of loss or depression or mental illness or whatever the case is, and they find someone that can, for whatever reason, speak to them in a language that makes sense to them but doesn't make sense to anyone else, and they end up following that person to the ends of the earth doing the most horrific things. It's so impossible to understand, I feel like. I really feel like it's one of those things we'll just never understand completely as a society. Because it's a culmination of factors, right? Because this happens often where cult leaders find people that will do horrible things for them if they just believe in them. And then when you sit down and you talk to me, like, well, that guy just sounds nuts. Like Charles Manson, I've never seen an interview where I understood what people were attracted to. But for whatever reason, dozens of them did.
Yeah. Most recently, I think we have the best example of the same sort of thing is the guy who was the head of NXIVM. You know, he is not someone who...
Or David Koresh. I mean, there's a lot of examples of it.
Well, the most recent one... I mean, David Koresh is another one, yes. But the most recent one, I think, is the NXIVM guy, because he's somebody who again, is... Like, David Koresh, I look at that guy, I sort of get it, you know? He looks like a decent dude. He looks like he knows what he's doing. The NXIVM guy, Charles Manson guy, they're not what you would typically say are people that have charisma.
But that's just it. That's the thing. Like, I don't think there's a certain level of charisma you have to have. It's you have to have people in a very specific place in their life that have, for whatever reason, believe in whatever you're believing in, and they believe you're the one that can lead them to the promised land of whatever it is that you believe.
That's fair.
The reality is he's not the type to invoke fear, right? Like, we get that. He's not the equivalent to, like, Pablo Escobar or something.
Escobar, maybe.
Even Escobar. I'm a little bit more scared of Escobar, but the biggest thing that comes into this is he had, and this was stated by multiple of his followers, he had this ability to manipulate individuals. And that's all it really is. It's manipulating them. To Aaron's point, it's people who are in a place where they can be manipulated, but... Are you laughing about Escobar?
Yes, I can't believe you invoked his name on this.
Well, you know, it's just a callback, right? Yeah, you know. Good old Cocaine Bear episode, if you haven't listened.
You know, you're just like the Pablo Escobar. What? How are we here again?
So with this, he had this ability to manipulate them. He, I guess there was one point where there was an acid trip that made him, that he interpreted as basically being Jesus Christ, like reincarnation of Jesus. And I feel like anytime you bring religion into people who have a hopeless life or they feel hopeless and give them some spark of hope that you are a successor, you are something that is magical, that transcends time and the universe and things like that. And you have people who are on drugs on top of that. It sure leads to the ability to be manipulated and bought into this. And on top of that, what I understand is that he had this Ted Bundy-like personality where he was able to charm and get people lured in initially with his like chill guitar playing hippie vibes. You know what I mean? Like he had a way to get people entered into his presence. And then he took the following steps to manipulate them and help, you know, him get what he wanted out of it. And at the end of the day, all it was is him just being really good at using people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some charisma there, I guess, you know? Yeah.
I guess I'm wrong. There is some charisma there. He was a performer and he was somebody, but that who was able to get himself into, sort of being, I guess, a Z level celebrity to some extent because he had connections in Hollywood and in the music business. Right. So I guess there's a lot of that. His background's something that I always found interesting because he doesn't come from like a background in which you would expect somebody to, I guess expect is the wrong word, because he does come from basically a background of growing up in crime, in being abandoned and being left to his own devices and having to fend for himself, which is a perfect building blocks for somebody like this.
What I find fascinating about this entire situation is everyone knows who Charles Manson is. Everyone knows about the Manson murders. Many people know who Sharon Tate is. Many people know Roman Polanski from other situations, which we're not going to get into.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. I feel bad in this scenario, but I don't feel bad in other situations. But that's beside the. That's a whole other case if we ever cover that one. But what boggles my mind is how little everybody actually knows about the murders that took place, because everyone knows Charles Manson, everyone knows the Manson murders. They've known that Sharon Tate was murdered. Most people don't know everybody else that was in the house. But the actual specifics, most people I know don't know those details until, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out and it kind of gave versions of those details, like recreated versions of those details. Up until then, many people I know had no idea how it happened.
Partially because of the time in which it was done, because information wasn't as readily available as it is today. But also, it's kind of it's the telephone game. As time has progressed, details have been lost, and it's become more and more about the people who committed the crime versus the people who were victimized by it. That's one of the things that I think a lot of true crime is starting to try to do these days, which is to keep the victims in play, keep the victims honored, and make it their story versus trying to make it the story about the criminals. You know, and a lot of what we find about people and how they decide they want to become known, there is a segment of people who run around and say, hey, I want to be famous and I'm going to do it by killing a bunch of people. Reducing the amount in which names get passed out or details get passed out is helpful in that respect.
Well, this one is a very horrific situation because it's very reminiscent of the Danny Rowling case where they just came in the middle of the night, except this is multiple people. They came in the middle of the night and destroyed several people's lives. It's just, it's insane. It's insane how this happened and rippled through history because it became one of the most horrific crimes in history. And many other cases of close to replicating that, like Jeffrey Donovan is very similar to the Manson murders, or I'm sorry, Jeffrey McDonald is what it was. He was the army captain whose pregnant wife and two daughters were murdered in like the 70s.
Right. And then recently the Kings Road murders.
Yeah. Kings Road murders too. Sure. Would apply. Mm-hmm. But the Jeffrey McDonald ones, they actually wrote in blood on the wall. It was very tied into the whole Manson concept.
And I think that element, you know, especially from the movie The Strangers, is what makes it so horrifying, because you were home. Mm-hmm. That means that there's no specific motive. There's nothing that you could or couldn't have done differently that would have prevented this. It's legitimately just, this could happen to anybody. We could have chose any house. We chose yours. You're the subject, which means, you know, that instills, I think, more fear than anything else, because you don't know what to do to prevent it. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's something that's more specific, or they have like characterizations that they're you know, targeting. A lot of times it's something specific with women. So we have all these different like preventative processes that we try to do, you know, which we've talked about on former episodes too. You don't have that when someone's just like, yeah, we just decided this was the right one. You know, we're here. You're here.
One thing I kind of love is how, and it isn't in Strangers, it isn't Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, how Tarantino took that really chilling line, I'm the devil and I'm here to do the devil's business, and made it like a joke. Just because it's
yeah.
Made yeah. it absolutely ridiculous. Because it is an absolutely ridiculous line, but in the course of murdering a bunch of several people in their, you know, home in the middle of the night, that's terrifying. But the way he did it with the whole joke and Brad Pitt's like, what? Like, just all of that made it funny.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's a good callback.
Yep.
Terrifying case, though. Like, when you actually go through the details, it's an absolutely terrifying case.
Yeah, and that was done and perpetrated in a time in which there was a much more common for people to be laxed about their home security, much mm-hmm. more laxed about how they answered the door or who they spent their time with. It's not like today where, you know, I was talking to some friends at the gym and they were telling me how anytime they meet somebody new, they go and do a deep dive on them on police records and stuff like that. I'm like, how do you people even find this stuff? But that's what they do now.
It never surprises me how depraved humanity is at times. You know, we've done several of these cases. The Danny Rowland case really stuck with me just because of how horrific those murders were. Murdering an eight month pregnant woman is just beyond insane to me. There's so many things where it's just like, you think, well, you know what? The world isn't as bad as we think it is. Then you look, dive into these and like, no, it really is. It's pretty bad.
It's actually worse than we thought. The other thing that always surprises me with this is how, you know, you go there with the intention, and I understand that the directions were a little bit unclear, right? So it was just murder everybody that's in this guy's house. So you don't know how they're connected to Melcher,
like
right?
An accident,
like that's
though,
the whole
right?
thing.
He didn't expect
it
them
is.
To be there. Yeah.
They didn't know that this house was now occupied by other people, but like, You don't recognize Sharon Tate? I feel like you probably recognize her. Like, that doesn't stop you or cause a logical moment to be like, dang, did we get the right house, guys? What's going on?
Yeah, but by that point, they're so hopped up on whatever it is they're on and so pumped up.
That's true. They already did murder someone and got
they're
this
already
far
committed.
Into it.
They're in a frenzy at that point. And you can tell they're in a frenzy because of just how much they do.
I mean, so many at least closing in on 100 stab wounds across the board. That's insane to me. Just, my God. Oh, my God. But that's not as bad as the next case, if you can believe it.
I don't believe it. Tell us about it, Aaron.
I do believe it because the world is terrible.
Yeah, the world is terrible. Well, the Keddie murders are also known as Cabin 28, if you haven't heard this or heard the very details, the very specific details of this case, it'll turn your stomach. So let me begin. Sue Sharp left her husband in 1979, taking her five children with her and relocating from Connecticut to Northern California. She initially rented a small trailer, but when Plumas County Sheriff Sylvester Douglas Thomas moved out of cabin number 28, Sue Sharp and her family moved in, and they consisted of 15-year-old son John, 14-year-old daughter Sheila, 12-year-old daughter Tina, 10-year-old Rick, and 5-year-old Greg at the time of the murders. On April 11, 1981, Sue, Sheila, and Greg were en route to pick up Rick from Quincy when they saw John and his 15-year-old friend Dana Hall Wingate hitchhiking. Sue gave them a ride to Keddie. 2 hours later, John and Dana hitchhiked back to Quincy, as they had plans to meet up with friends. They were seen downtown. Sheila had plans to spend the night in cabin number 27 with the Seabolt family. So Sue stayed home with Rick, Greg, and their friend Justin Smart. Sheila left cabin number 28 shortly after 8 p.m. to head to the Seabolts. And Tina, who had been at the Seabolts, returned to cabin 28 around 9:30. P.M. At around 8 a.m. on April 12, 1981, the next morning, Sheila returned home to Cabin 28. At that time, she discovered the bodies of John, his friend Dana, and her mother Sue. Tina was missing. Rick, Greg, and Justin were all found safe in an adjacent bedroom. Although they claimed to have slept through the murders, it was later discovered that the boys witnessed at least a portion of these events. The murders of John, Dana, and Sue were vicious. All three victims had been tied up with medical tape and electrical cords. Two bloodied knives and a hammer were found on site. One knife was bent almost in half. All of the murders occurred in the living room. John's throat had been slashed. Dana had been strangled to death. Both boys had been bludgeoned repeatedly before their deaths. Sue was found on her side, on her couch, nude from the waist down, gagged with a blue bandana and her own panties. She had been stabbed in the chest and throat. The wound went as deep as her spine, and on the side of her head, there was an imprint, matching the butt with Daisy 880 Powerline BB gun. Tina was still missing, as were her jacket and shoes. She was reported missing but not found until April 22, 1984, 3 years later. A skull was found in Feather Falls, about 100 miles from Keddy, and those remains were identified as Tina's. Shortly after the remains were found but not identified, the sheriff's office received an anonymous call identifying those remains as Tina's. But this call was not documented, though the recording was found decades later in 2013. No one was charged with these murders. No one was proved culpable, though there was a neighbor, Martin Smart, that was liked as a main suspect. It has never been proven, and he did die in June 2000. A hammer that matched the description of one that Martin Smart claimed to have lost around the time of the murders was found in a local pond in 2016. And that's all we know about the Keddy murders.
Again, incredibly horrific, and people who just like take pleasure in being gruesome.
This one bothers me more than the Manson murders, because with the whole fact that it's unsolved, the whole fact that there's no underlying motive behind this, or at least an understanding of the motive, that's why this one bothers me the most of the two of them. Because the other ones, we have the story and we know why they were set upon like they were. Here, it's literally people just showed up, did something and left and never once were heard from again.
And to a bunch of kids. And also, I mean, it leaves so many questions. Why just those four? Why not the others that were in the other bedroom? Why did they take Tina? What did they do to Tina? How long was Tina alive after this happened? You know what I mean? Like, there's just so many remaining questions.
Yeah, I'm not asking any of those questions. I'm not. I don't want to know what happened to Tina. I don't want to know why they took her.
It's just terrible.
Yeah.
It's disturbing. There have been many documentaries and true crime podcasts that go into all the details. I mean, there's a lot there. But the fact that Justin said that he didn't see anything. Then he said he dreamed the details and then did a description of the perpetrators, etc. Like, there's a lot of unsures there. A lot of confusing points. We're dealing with kids. You don't know what kids see and what they don't see, but we don't want to speculate. I just want to be one of those podcasts that speculates on who committed atrocious crimes. But it is fascinating. It's a fascinating case. Horrific, yes, but also fascinating. And once again, man, can you imagine someone that was staying just, you know, down the way, just right next door to your own mother's house or cabin, and no one hears anything? No one sees really anything? It's mind-boggling right to me. You just assume that people are going to, well, there's got to be witnesses, right? Because, I mean, you think about if something like that happened, three people are butchered and one is taken out of the house, somebody's going to hear something. But that's not the case, and it happens very frequently that that's not the case.
Oof, sorry, that just put me in a place that, oof.
I hope it's a quiet place, because that would make the rest of the podcast better.
Okay.
Oof. Zynga. Just kidding. I'm kidding, John. I'm kidding. Don't leave. Come back. All right, well, lastly, there's one more story to tell in regards to the strangers. So writer Brian Bertino mentioned he was also inspired by a situation that happened to him as a child. It was at night, and his parents left him at home alone with his little sister. Their home was a house in the middle of nowhere, and later that night, someone knocked on the front door, which his little sister then answered. They asked for someone who didn't live there, and then they went away, leaving the kids unnerved. What they later found out was that these people were knocking on doors in the area, and if anyone didn't answer, if anyone wasn't home, they then robbed those homes.
Oof.
They also came back asking for the same person again, which makes it even creepier.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure you're home, little girl? Mm-hmm.
The devil, as some may say, knocked on their door twice.
But at least they were just robbing. You know, it doesn't sound like they
were. Yeah, I guess that's the positive. But I will say, robbing, if people are home, robbers will, depending on the individuals, but it can often lead to physical injury to the individuals in the home.
Yeah, as people are trying to defend themselves and they end up in worse situations. Yeah. And some people believe, well, if you don't do anything, they'll just take what they want and leave. I'm not going to take that chance.
Nope. Mm-mm.
I will go back to my story about my grandmother just super quick. They went to her house intentionally to rob her, to steal her vehicle. Mm-hmm. And solely because, and she was asleep through all of that. Like, they could have taken the keys and they could have left. They could have gotten what they wanted. But because she was there, the main guy, I should say, wanted to pretty much take her out, leave no witnesses. And that's what perpetuated the whole situation. So even if you're quiet, even if you're asleep, they could still be inspired to come for you.
Yeah, you just never
even
know.
If they're just there to rob. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I have my own story that's kind of like this as far as being a kid in a weird situation where we were home. It was us kids. Both my parents worked. I think it was in the middle of the summer. And it was us with the, you're all going to sit there and like look down at your nose at me for saying this next phrase. But our maids were with us.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In Panama.
Okay. In Panama. Mm-hmm. And we were in the kids' room, as it was called, which was a side room that
which
was built
the side
onto
house.
The, well, which was a side room built onto the house,
the
which
pool house.
which is where we had our kids' TV and our kids' area, and this is where we spent most of our time.
And this is where cash rained down from the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. One of the windows was kind of cracked, and we look over as we're playing one day, and there's this set of hands that is just messing with the windows.
Oh no!
Yeah,
that's it's terrifying.
Just a set of hands, and so we got Angela's attention, which was one of our maids. She sat there and she watched and she saw the hands, and so she pops her head out and screams bloody murder. As she sees this guy trying to essentially climb up to where this window was, and yet his pants were down.
What?
Yeah, it was a whole thing.
Hold on. This story got dark, really, like a quick turn.
Did he not have a belt? Maybe he didn't have a belt. Let's try to look at the optimistic side.
He didn't have... His pants were all the way down.
Okay. So he had
and his undies.
He was doing something.
And his undies.
Both layers were all the way down. And as soon as he saw it was like, I guess, a grown up or something, there was a tension that was drawn to him, he took off running into the woods like...
With his pants down? Because that's a hilarious sight, if so.
Well, yeah. Like he was starting to pull them up as he was running.
Waddle,
but
waddle, 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 waddle.
we called the MPs and Guardias over and everything, and they went into the woods looking for him, and it was a whole thing. But yeah, I've had a similar kind of story.
Did they ever find him?
No.
He probably went to somebody else's house.
Or, you know, yeah, it's possible. Or
icky.
You know, it's a rainforest. You never can tell what's going to happen in a rainforest.
You think maybe he got mauled by some animal and died?
That would be fun.
That would be fun.
Or he just escaped.
Karma. Or he escaped.
He just escaped.
I like the idea that karma happened.
Or he just escaped.
Like Pablo Escobar jumped out of nowhere and just took him down?
Yeah, see, that's what I'm looking for.
I mean, I think everybody has a little story like that. I could tell you a bunch of them, but I actually grew up very, very poor. I didn't have any maids, that's for sure.
Both my parents worked. Come on.
My mom worked.
He only had one parent. How about them apples?
I still didn't have a maid. I don't care if I had six parents. I didn't have a maid. I lived in the projects. I was very, very poor. We came home and there were always...
Should have grown up in another country.
Yeah, apparently. Apparently. So anyway, but these are like three stories, one back to back to back of horrific things that happen in the middle of the night when you should be safe at home. So it just goes to show, like, even then, you know, we used to think, oh, you can leave your door open all the time. No, you really shouldn't. You never know. You never know. Take security you can, you know?
I think the difference between, you know, because there is that concept of like, oh, kids used to be able to play on the street and we didn't have to worry. They could go do whatever wanted, or we could leave our doors unlocked and we didn't have to worry about someone breaking in. No, bud, you just got lucky. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that the internet happened and made it very, very accessible for us to be constantly aware of the things that are happening. Now, I'm not going to say that there hasn't been an increase in crime. Like, obviously,
it's been decreased over the years. That's actually statistically.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, screw me and my wrong math.
The reason why it's been decreased is population growth. So,
oh, see, there you go. There you go.
You don't know that's the reason. A lot more people have Ring doorbell cameras now. A lot more people have cameras in their houses. They have more security systems. Like, there's a greater prominence of attacking versus reacting. Yeah, being proactive. Exactly. Versus being proactive versus being reactive. There's a huge influx of that. Where in the old days, we didn't do anything security-wise until after we were robbed or after someone you know, came to the door and did something creepy. That's when we did something. Nowadays, people are very proactive about it. So let's talk about the strangers a little bit. So in terms of the movie, right? I think the overlasting impression with the movie for me was it was terrifying because it tapped into that fear that everyone has that nobody talks about, is that fear of someone coming into your house the middle of the night and you not being able to do anything about it. You know, there's a moment where Liv Tyler is inside her house and she thinks she's safe because everything's outside. And then you see the killer behind her, or the eventual killers. One of them is behind her in her own house while she thinks she's still safe. That's a terrifying moment to know that, well, they're already in there. They've already figured out how to be in this house.
That was so well done.
It was very subtle, quiet, wasn't showy, you know, didn't do anything dramatic. It was just, we saw it, she didn't see it, and it terrified us because then you don't know when is that character going to pop out again.
You know, as far as the movie's concerned, one of the things that I liked about it is very little in the way of jump scares. It was more tension.
Mm-hmm. The atmosphere.
Yeah, tension and atmosphere. Build up the tension, let it go a little bit. Build up the tension, let it go a little bit. And occasionally there'd be something that, because of the rhythm, made sense to have a scare that could be categorized as a jump or something like that. But the tension was something that was so wonderfully done.
Yeah, and the little things that kind of led up to each moment too, right? Like, there was a slow build to getting to the point of them actually being in the home, doing things with the individuals. They took their time. They didn't rush in. They wanted to bring the horror to that person's face, and they wanted to be a part of that. And that required them being stealthy and getting into the home. And there's the one thing that I didn't like too much that I struggled with, because there are those really great moments that are built up and the tension is there and they're trying to do this slow build and add in, you know, kind of sprinkle it in to really play with the individual's mind and the audience's mind and all of that tension that's being drummed up as you go along, because they're not hitting the house real hard. They're not going right in. But I felt like I had so much slow build in the beginning, too, of the relationship that it made it feel like the entire movie was too drawn out until we got to that point.
I felt like I appreciated what they were trying to do, right? The whole idea with the relationship was they were trying to show she wasn't ready for marriage. They were just showing like this whole couple's dynamic.
Justifying.
And just going through this very quickly, like, here's where they are in this stage of their relationship. Here's why they're having a little bit of a tiff. And then you get the end moment where she wears the ring and it's just like, oh my gosh, she realizes that he's the one, da da da. It's a very heartbreaking moment at the end. I don't know. I think they spoke to it too much in the beginning, where it kind of drug it out a little bit. And Scott Speedman, you know, I know John has his issues with him, which he'll talk about in a second, but I didn't really have as many issues with him. My only issue probably is more some of the things they didn't do when they should have done them. But it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback when people are victims of crimes, because you might have done something completely different, but other people would have done these same things. You know, they would have handled it the same way, because men are very macho and they think it's no big deal, you know, and women can be skittish. Like, these are all stereotypes that people have. And I would like to think that people would handle it completely different, but you just never know until you're in the situation.
Yeah, my issue with Scott Speedman is I didn't find him to be macho. I didn't find him to be much of anything. I just felt like he was in a different movie, because it was like things were affecting Liv Tyler in a way that were almost punched you in the gut. But things were affecting him in a way that he was just walking down the street or something. I spent part of the movie up until a certain point. I've spent part of the movie going, oh, he's in on this. This is something he set this up. He had something to do with this, because
he was too laid back.
Because he's way too laid back about everything. Oh, and that was also like the, I'll go out and get you cigarettes, even though there's a cigarette still left in your ashtray there that you could just smoke, and then you can probably rest off. But, you know, whatever. He's going to go do stupid things at 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't understand, but I didn't buy it. It wasn't until Mike showed up and he accidentally killed Mike did I buy the fact that he is a victim in this as well.
Oof, that was a brutal one.
That was brutal. And that was another moment where it was excellently executed, because you got Mike walking down the hallway slowly, kind of looking side to side to the other rooms, being like, hello, what's going on? And you can see the masked man behind him, and it's about to become a thing, or you're about to think it's going to be a thing. But you can also almost build up to know or see the fact that the outcome of what was really going to happen right there and then. So that was brutal. But yeah, it wasn't until then do you believe, okay, no, Scott Speedman's in this. But most of the time I'm like, he's in a different movie.
And in many respects, if he wouldn't have shot him, they might get out of there alive.
Oh yeah.
You know?
I don't know why Mike wasn't making a bigger noise about him being in there, because obviously there's something going on. And again, easy to Monday morning quarterback this, but if it was me showing up in my friend's house and there's weird things about, I'm like, hello?
No, what I do is I leave and I go get the police immediately. But that's, again, Monday morning quarterback. You're also concerned with your friends, but do you want to announce your presence in case there's somebody still in the house? I mean, there's a lot of things. This movie plays with a lot of those things.
Right. I get it.
And we can also, it's easy for us sitting outside the situation to say, here's what we would do if we were in that situation. But when your brain is frazzled, like if you truly are terrified, your brain can respond differently and will respond differently unless you've been in terrifying situations before where you know that you are 100% able to control your mind and emotions and be logical. And a lot of people aren't. They're going to respond to the emotions that they have, and it's going to distract them, and it's going to make them do things that they ordinarily would never do.
Absolutely. What did you guys think about the ending where the two kids come by the house, which I thought was very sweet. Like, they're just, you know, hey, we're here, missionaries, whatever we are. And then they find out Liv Tyler is alive. What did you think about that ending? That was quite the shock.
That kind of blew me away. The thing that I liked more about the ending wasn't necessarily that, but it was just how we never got the payoff to see what the strangers look like, right? You think at one point they get out of the car, they go in, they talk to the Mormon kids. Are you a sinner? Sometimes. that was a whole weird moment, but I thought that was going to be a great payoff where we finally see who they are, or at least get an idea of what's going on. But then you realize who they are or what their faces look like didn't matter, because they just personified these ghosts or this feeling of dread.
I don't want to see their faces. I never wanted to see their faces. That's something I think works in the movie's favor, the entire series, both films. Like, if you see their face, it takes away. It takes a piece of the horror away. Not knowing who they are just shows that this could be anyone. This could be anyone you come across in your daily life.
Mm-hmm. And you never know who you're going to come across. Mm-hmm. But I did like that. For most of these types of movies, if people are going to be dead, they're going to be dead. So to have some sort of like glimmer of hope, you know what I mean? And give some like optimism. And the reality is, people can survive really horrific, crazy things. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that it reminds me of is that if you are a fighter, if you don't give up, not always, but you can beat the odds. You can survive. And I mean, like, I'm going to stop going back to my grandmother's story after this, but they literally told her in the hospital, if you wouldn't have fought so hard for yourself, you wouldn't be alive right now. And I think that that's what it is. Like, it's reminding you that people can survive and can overcome even the most brutal of situations.
Man, her life's going to suck after that, right?
It ain't going to be good. No. That's for sure.
That's not going to be great.
You know, maybe if I
imagine,
just imagine
if I would have said, yeah, exactly. If I would have just said yes, we wouldn't even be here right now.
We might have been having a honeymoon somewhere. We would have been like staying the night in a hotel. None of this would have happened. Yeah. We wouldn't have been home.
Well, no, they would have banged out a good one and been dead asleep when somebody was knocking on the door and never gotten up.
Or that approach, John.
No, they would have been out celebrating. Yep, like, things exactly. would have lasted a lot. Like, they would have...
You guys don't remember that they came home and that he had flowers and stuff all over the place as if they were supposed to be
celebrating. I remember that, but they left earlier because he was upset. He was upset, so they left, and it was very down.
They were supposed to come home to the celebration. Exactly. They would have stayed there longer. They would have, you know, probably done something after.
Had fun. Lived life.
Yep. Yep. And instead... It ended.
Just goes to show, ladies, whenever a guy proposes, you have to say yes.
This is bad. No, this is bad advice. More than likely, you probably need to say no.
Let's
be honest.
I know it's weird, but that's probably my favorite aspect of the character moments in the movie, is that she had the audacity in that moment to say no, because that's what you should do if you're not sure. Don't just say yes because of, you know, somebody. That's why I don't like these big proposals, like when people do them at sporting events and concerts and things like that. Like, that's not fair to the person you're proposing to, because that doesn't give them the window to say no. And I really admire that her character said no. I mean, she changed her mind as she went. Well, yeah, she's on death's door. Of course she's changed her mind. This is the last guy I'm ever going to be with. So I guess, you know, I wish I would have. But overall, she probably made the right call.
Also, don't propose to somebody unless you guys have talked about marriage and that person is like, yeah, I'd get married tomorrow to you.
Yeah, you're
like,
the one.
If you guys aren't for certain and you've had those conversations, just don't be doing that. Yeah.
One more reason not to like Scott Speedman's James, I guess. He didn't.
Yeah. Of course he didn't pay attention. He doesn't pay attention to much of anything until it's like in his face. And even then he's like, oh, I shot my friend. Crap.
Crap.
Hold on a second. Let me write some of this down. Do not propose until you have. All right, got it. Yeah.
Get the approval first. You got to really fish it. I will tell you, been in that boat, man. I have proposed and got the no. It's not a fun day. It's not.
Have you
day.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, oof.
To my current wife.
Oh, all right. Well,
well, yeah. If you just keep
she
going.
Was smart.
If you're persistent enough, maybe she'll say yes eventually.
The first time she said no. Yep. And it was devastating. And I did the whole thing. But the second time, you didn't get any of that shit. It was just like, want to? Okay.
You know. It was a text message or something.
Yeah,
he
really.
Was like, hey, want to get married?
Oh, so many terrible things I can say right now.
Hey, I left your ring on the bathroom counter if you're down.
All fair.
This suddenly explains so much.
Doesn't it? Doesn't
it? It does.
I do like how this the film, in terms of taking the inspiration, it does completely make its own thing. Like, there is no, I mean, yes, it was inspired by these things, but it's really its own story. And it's fascinating how the movie worked out. And actually, yes, it does have elements of those crimes. Prey at Night has a lot more of the elements of the Keddie murders, for sure. But they're also, they're very much their own thing. How it plays out is very different. Like, how everything rolls is completely its own thing, which is nice, because you can read, you can hear the elements and you can hear the actual stories, and you get that chill factor because, oh my God, that's so kind of close to what happened, but also completely separate enough that you can enjoy the movie and not have to think about those crimes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
Anything more on Strangers or Strangers Prey at Night or this whole new trilogy of this series that is coming out eventually?
I don't know if we need a new trilogy of the series, but I would have to say that, as this being my first experience with this movie and hopefully my last experience with Scott Speedman.
Jeez. You have so many issues.
Well, the only thing I remember the guy from is this now and the Underworld movies. And he wasn't graded in that.
If it makes you feel better, he's in Grey's Anatomy.
No.
You know, what the movie got right and did it respect the victims, it wasn't really retelling those stories, so it's okay. I feel like it's telling the just an overall terrifying story, and it handled that right.
I think it handled it right, too. The fact that it didn't really try to make itself something that was like the other stories does play to its favor, and I wouldn't really change any of that aspect. I would say it's great that they took the inspiration and did exactly what the inspiration should do, which is to give us all sort of a entertaining lesson that sort of scares the crap out of us.
What would you have done differently with the main one, The Strangers? Would you have done anything differently with that film?
I personally would have integrated the relationship storyline a little bit differently. I see that there's value, especially like beginning to end type of thing, but there were a lot of moments with their relationship feud that I just didn't care about. Mm-hmm. And that made it almost difficult for me to stay involved waiting for this to happen. So I think if they would have paced it out a little bit differently, where they started bringing in the strangers a little bit sooner, and then we learn more about their relationship and what was going on throughout the movie, that I think would have played better for me personally.
I do think I would have liked to have seen hints of the strangers before even the door knock situation. You know, they pull up to the house and we can see shadows, or we see it from the point of view of shadows looking at the house or something to that effect. That would have been cool. I don't mind the relationship aspect or how they played it out, because it made sense. I didn't get the impression that they were necessarily ending their relationship there and then, especially when they were about to have that moment before the door knock situation. So I felt like there was still a lot of love between the two of them, and I thought that part was sweet, even though they were obviously having a hard moment. And she was obviously going, it's not that I don't want to be with you. It's more like I'm not ready for that sort of commitment kind of thing. So I appreciate those aspects of what we saw, but I think I would have definitely hinted more at the strangers and hinted more and started building the tension so much sooner than they did.
One thing I will say is that the movie doesn't do James any favors, because he's basically an asshole, plain and simple.
That's true.
I mean, she said no. I mean, I get you put in all this work, but on the same token, you should have got the yeah ahead of time. Should have known how it was going to roll out, and you shouldn't be mad that she said no. You could be hurt, but he was basically just being in it. I mean, he was trying to be
subdued. Was bitter.
Yeah, he was just bitter. Just bitter. I'm like, well, this is why you don't deserve to be married to her. God, man.
And also, he was very dismissive of her concerns. Exactly. And that really frustrated me. I feel like if that would have been different, it would have made him a more likable character that we wanted to follow too, that we wanted to see succeed, where he could have... that would have demonstrated that, damn girl, like maybe you should have said yes. Like this is a good guy. He's looking out for you. He's trying to take care of you and make sure you're safe. Like instead of basically dismissing her concerns, he should have said immediately, like, hang up the phone, call the police. Like, I'm worried about you. Right. I'm coming back right now. And then he walks into like a situation or whatever. That I think would have played out a lot better too. And it would have made the end more emotionally impactful because quite honestly, did anybody really care about him other than how it would impact her?
No, you're right.
Exactly. So it's like I would have liked her to be not ready, but he's a really great guy. And like we want them to be together. And oh, this is so, you know, terrible. And he's starting to take care of her. He's trying to look out for her, you know, basically being like alpha dude or whatever for her, but like not in an overbearing way. Mm-hmm. And then by the end, you're like, man, that's really sad because now she has to live without this person that she realizes is such a great guy. And that the whole time, if she would have said yes, and she should have said yes, and we would have been like, dang girl, oof.
I think by 2008 standards, he did enough to be considered a good guy.
No, he didn't. Nope. I don't agree with you. He didn't take her seriously throughout the entire situation. When she raised her concerns, he didn't get her out of that house like he should have. He didn't call the police like he should have. He wasn't concerned about her safety. He left her alone right after some weird ass person comes at 4 a.m. showing up to the door. That's because he was, you know, mopey. That's just, he's just a dick.
Selfish. He was thinking about himself. Very
selfish. Yeah, self-involved. He's not a good guy in my book.
And like, I understand there's a hurt element, but like, even for 2000, I feel like 2008, people were more chivalrous than they are now. That's for dang sure.
No.
So him in 2008, he should have been the chivalrous guy. He should have been the one and to me, that is a demonstration of how much you love somebody. I love you enough that even though you said no to my proposal or I'm not ready yet, that we're still going to try to work through this and I still love you. So I'm going to take care of you at every end, at every turn. That's demonstrating you love someone selflessly.
Look, the strangers did her a favor. That's all I'm going to say. Like, she might have taken...
Honestly!
She might have taken a knife, but she dodged a bullet. You know what I'm saying?
Well done. Well done. Nicely well done. Sometimes women, we need people to take care of things for us. We're not good decision makers sometimes. So, you know what? I think you're right, Aaron. They helped her out. They did her a solid.
I would agree. They probably did her a solid. But I also don't know any of that life you're talking about, Amanda.
This is for our follow-up therapy session, John.
Wow. All right, fine.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share the show on your social media outlets. Give us a review in your favorite podcast app, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, whatever it is you listen to. Give us a review there. It really does help because you are, once again, our best source of promotion. So tell your true crime fans about it. It really does help. And thank you for listening once again to Inspired by a True Story. Now let's keep those artists honest. While Polanski was in Europe working on a film, their friends Wojciech Frykowski.
I want all of this in the outtakes.
No,
I want all of this in the outtakes. It has to be in the outtakes.
This one does. This one has to be.